Hello, I am Sister Teresa Shields, and we are starting the podcast, Holy Name Sisters, Women on a Mission. And I'm Sister Teresa, along with
Sister Mimi Maloney.
And today, before we introduce our guest, we are going to say a short prayer. So let's have a moment of silence. We desire God. We desire what God desires. We desire God's justice, tenderness, and communion. With gratitude for all that has been, and with hearts open to all that is yet to be, we pray for companions on our journey into a future unknown and full of promise. Amen.
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 So today, Mimi and I are thrilled to have as our guest Sister Lois McGillivray, who's had a wonderful career her whole life with the Holy Name Sisters. She taught elementary school for a while and then went to graduate school. Tell us about that, Lois. Tell us where you went and what your studies were and why we are so excited to have you today.
Well, I went to the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and with a major in sociology, and I earned both a master's and a PhD there. Afterwards, I continued my research on American cities, which had been part of my dissertation, when I joined the Research Triangle Institute in Durham, North Carolina, and stayed there until the community asked me to come to Holy Names College, which is now Holy Names University in Oakland.
So Lois, as a research sociologist at the University of North Carolina, you began working on evaluation studies with the Kellogg Institute. Tell us maybe one of those projects that you were involved in, and tell us a little bit about evaluation studies, what's involved in that, please.
I didn't begin evaluation studies until after my years at Holy Names University. When I returned to North Carolina after 10 years at Holy Names, I began to do applied research, and the first three projects I worked on were all funded by the Kellogg Foundation, and they were all focused on North Carolina. The first one was a cultural study that brought a group of artists and dancers from this nation of Columbia to the rural parts of North Carolina as a way of expanding their understanding of the world. And they asked me if I would do the evaluation. An evaluation tries to ask, what was this group trying to do? What happened? What were their challenges? What were the things they were able to do? What came of it? Did they reach the goals that they wanted? So that's basically what the work is. After the cultural study, I did a study that Kellogg funded to expand the nonprofit management program of Duke University around the state. North Carolina has a wonderful tradition of nonprofit service organizations, but Kellogg was worried about how many of them were fragile, financially, legally fragile. So they thought if they could have a set of study skills, a couple of years, get a certificate, people could get a certificate in nonprofit management through Duke, that would strengthen the nonprofit sector all across the state of North Carolina. One of the other projects that Kellogg funded was to fund the Wild Acres Leadership Initiative, which was a funding for a group of leaders, emerging leaders who were all roughly around 40 years old and in multiple sectors like business and law, medicine, education, nonprofit service organizations. Try to bring these people together to begin to talk across their differences of gender, race, sexual identity, political ideology, religion. And these were things that polarized politicians in North Carolina or influential blocks in North Carolina. And the hope was that by having these conversations, people would continue to have differences, but know how to talk civilly across them. And so again, the work was, what did they try to do? What were their challenges and what were the things that worked well? And one example of what worked well, one person who's a very liberal woman politician in the state assembly, met regularly with a newspaper editor who was very conservative ideologically. And together they worked on several projects that they thought were good for North Carolina. One was to limit the amount of gambling so that they could find a common area where they could work together because they knew each other and trusted each other.
That is wonderful. Some of those projects, I want to talk to you about each one. So that is what motivated...
It's very rich work. It's wonderful
I
work.
I bet.
Yes.
You're right. Mm-hmm. What motivated mm-hmm. Kellogg? Who wrote the big grant to Kellogg? Was it a combination of nonprofit leaders and government leaders? Because it sounds like millions of dollar projects.
The first cultural project was written by a small nonprofit that was trying to improve the awareness. North Carolina has a large rural area, and the children there do not have access to mind-broadening experiences. And so this nonprofit wrote a small grant to Kellogg to see if they could bring this troupe of artists and musicians for about a week or 10 days to some schools in the rural part of the state. The Duke University project was written by the Duke Center, the part of Duke that worked for nonprofits. It wasn't the academic part of the school, but the service part of the university. And
The leadership project
was written by the Wild Acres Institute, which was a nonprofit that operated in the mountains of North Carolina, and its whole idea was to improve the diversity, a conversation around diversity. It was founded by a group of Jewish merchants and then expanded to bring in other groups. And the whole purpose was to have these conversations. My particular part of that was the group that was called the Friday Fellows, named for the first president of the University of North Carolina. And that was this group, this effort to bring the young leaders together, and was funded for probably 3 or 4 years. I think each of the grants was funded for 2, 3, 5 years, that area.
Thank you, Lois. That would be rewarding work, helping people communicate, crossing all sorts of lines that otherwise could be barriers. So you also worked on a project aimed at helping with youth offenders in North Carolina. Can you tell us a little bit about that research that you did and what you found out?
Mm-hmm. The project was actually a federal project. So it was across the United States, not just in North Carolina. And it was funded by the U.S. Department of Labor. I was still a consultant at that time, but I had been a colleague of a wonderful African-American social psychologist, Dr. Peggy Richmond. We had worked on a couple of projects where she thought it would be helpful to have both a Black and white professional presence so that the appearance would be indicate that it was we were trying to be even-handed. And so when this opportunity came up, the U.S. Department of Labor had worked with Peggy for a number of years, and they had this project that they wanted her to consider, and that was to provide the evaluation of a demonstration. So it's a special kind of project. It's not a get in and be operational project. It was trying to do a kind of research project. And it was called the Youth Offender Demonstration Project. Some of the research demonstrated with adults that if they could get a job as soon as they were released from court supervision, that they were much less likely to fall back into crime. And the department was wondering if that same idea could be applied to young people, and the young people roughly 16 to 24. So it put out a request for proposals to the cities across the country and asking them to send in a proposal that they would work to implement this demonstration project.
So what did you find out, or what were some of the conclusions with the youth offenders, Lois? Can you talk a bit about that?
Well, I think I probably need to talk a little bit about, I go back to this was a demonstration. So it wasn't just get kids jobs, you know, it was trying to help them finish their high school education, learn something about work readiness, get some experience in work. It helped with job placement and helped with job retention. So it really had five or six parts to it. And the real problem that occurred for us as the evaluators was the cities at this time were losing youth funding. There had always been a tradition in most large cities of having summer jobs programs for teens. That kind of money was getting cut because of the general economic situation. So even though this project was so carefully defined as a demonstration, most of the cities took it as we just have to get kids jobs. We just have to get teens jobs. So there were only a handful out of almost 50 projects. There were only a handful that took the demonstration side of this really carefully and designed a project that aimed directly at young people, either already in court supervision or in danger of court supervision, got them engaged with the project, found ways to keep them active in the project long enough to actually finish their high school and stay. High school always ran along with job training. So that wasn't just one and then the other, but they were learning job readiness skills along the way and made a serious effort to get them work experience before they were set loose on a, what you might call a real job, and provide job retention services. Those that did the whole demonstration, the young people did better. When they did a larger quantitative analysis of the whole multiple years of projects, they put the outcomes for those projects that were careful in with those that just got jobs for kids. And so if you look at that, it sounds like nothing much works. And it's an ongoing issue with evaluating public projects that so much of it requires the commitment of the local scene and their supervisors. Federal money coming into a city is still under the supervision of the state. The city is a creature of the state. The federal government can only suggest, recommend, urge that people follow these regulations for this demonstration. But if the city or state, state or county does not insist on it also, the project people can do what's in front of them. And as I would say, they were hardworking people who loved young people, were trying to keep them out of trouble. Right. It's just, and they felt they were doing their job to get them jobs. It looked like not much worked. And as you might guess from the fact that I've been doing this for a while, it is an ongoing issue of how to keep the design intact through a whole project in order for the outcomes to be attributed to the demonstration. So frustrating that a good effort comes up short when in fact it probably did a very good job where it was implemented carefully.
That's the challenge of the evaluator.
Yeah. Well, and see, we don't have any power. We just document.
Right.
You know? So we can say this is how they're reading the project, or and everybody involved from the federal government on down can try to intervene if they're interested. Many of them weren't. Many of the states were just happy those young people were getting jobs, so they weren't intervening either. So anyway, it was a wonderful project. We met wonderful people. There was no real issue around malfeasance or nonfeasance. No. They were all working hard. It was just the money was too small and a problem that was too big, and they were going to do the best they could.
And I think this totally fits in with Holy Name Sisters, Women on a Mission, because part of our charism is to work with the help the most vulnerable among us. And you were doing that with the children who could easily have gone into prison in their future life or not finished their education. So thank you, Lois, for that. And I think we want to talk to you, right, Mimi, about another really exciting project that Lois was working on. So
that's right. Lois, you also work with early education and young children and trying to improve that. Can you tell us about that study?
Yes, that was also a U.S. Department of Labor project, and it was the impetus for it came from Hillary Clinton. She had a White House conference not long after her husband had been inaugurated, and asking workers what was the biggest problem they had in trying to improve their situation. And they said, among other things, but very high on the list, was they did not have adequate care for their children. And so they began to look at the situation in which early care and education providers did not have much education themselves. They weren't formally educated in early care and education. And the wages are so low that the turnover is very high, like 40% a year, so that the children don't have a consistent leader, teacher, guide, nurturer, and the business doesn't get stronger because it's a constantly new workforce. So the U.S. Department of Labor asked, is it possible that using the registered apprenticeship system to improve the education of early education workers could stabilize the workforce by increasing both the skill level and the wage level of the workers? Again, we met wonderful people, and the project was its own kind of demonstration project because it was trying something that had not been tried before. You might not be surprised, but the early education centers in cities that had larger numbers took to the project much more easily than small family-run early care projects out in the small towns and rural areas. The idea of trying to improve skills was met with such interest by the workers, unlike the youth offenders who you had to keep trying to allure into the project. The early care and education workers were dying to get something beyond high school for themselves and improve their situation. But the wages were starting so low that even though they got like 50 cents an hour increase at certain 6-month intervals, that was still so small increments. And that was a real barrier. But as long as the project lasted, the whole demonstration project lasted, the education levels of the target workers did improve, and they did improve the level of wage. But as you know, looking around in 2021, early care and education is still severely underfunded. And trying to have a college level person responsible for early care and education, who is then able to train the less well-educated workers, continues to be an issue. But I think the demonstration of the work said that if you offer those people an education, they will flock to it. They will be delighted to try to find a way to improve their situation.
Wonderful. Thank you.
And we also did a project within the state. Maybe I should mention that while we're in early care and education. North Carolina has 100 counties from the mountains to the sea. And every county has a North Carolina Partnership for Children. And it's very much the same idea as what the apprenticeship program was trying to do. It provides a center in every county for improving the education and skills and the knowledge of the early care and education workers. The idea is to prepare them to make sure the children are ready for first grade. And they work on things like nutrition, making sure that they have good lunches and healthy snacks, that they learn their colors and their numbers, that they learn their songs, they have good athletic opportunities, that they're not just kept in a house. It's all levels of what children need. And then the North Carolina Partnership staff are given workshops and in-service to keep improving their knowledge. It's a really wonderful system. And so our effort there was to evaluate the effort to improve the education level of early education workers. And then just as we were finishing, Kellogg, one more time, came back into North Carolina and funded a pilot project. And they wanted just 7 school districts. They wanted to study ready schools. To what extent are the schools ready to take fragile learners, those who've come not with a lot of support from their family or their community to be ready for first grade? What do they do to make it easy for those youngsters to get into school and be successful right from the beginning? We really found that readiness was quite varied. We had some places where the children just showed up on the first day of school. Another, we had the teachers go to the early care and education settings and work with those people to get to know the children who would be in their class the next fall, meet the children, have the children and their parents come to the school, have something nice there, a snack, and they walk around and they meet their teachers, their classrooms, and they're told how wonderful it's all going to be. And the children arrive already feeling they know everybody. And it did make a difference. It did make a difference. And one of the school districts had a school that was only K to two. They found that schools that go all the way up to eighth grade in particular, where they start getting into sports and other things, the little ones get sort of lost. So they wanted to have one school that was kind of like a model for all the early years of education for the whole district, and that they also took in children who seemed particularly fragile around reading or numbers. Good. And they would try to get them mainstreamed into their own neighborhood school before the end of first grade. And then they stayed with them. And so they just supported those children into their early years. And then Kellogg changed its priorities. It had been spending millions of dollars on early education in the United States and decided that people knew pretty much from some of the studies that have been done what's needed, and it was up to their will to do it. And they deflected their interest into developing countries.
I want to ask you another question regarding that. How did this early education project partner, or did it with Head Start?
Head Start was a part of it. That was part of the network. But there never were enough, let me just use the word seats. There were never enough seats for all the children who qualified for Head Start.
That's true.
So that was one piece of the early education in each of the counties. But there were all these other children who weren't getting those services. One of the first big studies of early education is called the Abecedarian study, ABCDE. Right. Okay, the Abecedarian study was done in North Carolina. So a lot of their understanding came from that. And they knew that the children tended to lose ground by the third grade. In other words, early period education got them ready for first grade, but they got lost again. I think the Head Start research says they get up to about fourth grade and then they start slowing down,
losing,
and not keeping up. So a lot of the Ready School, a lot of this early care and education was trying to get the youngsters more sturdy and ready, hoping to get over that third or fourth grade lip, you might say, on the path forward. Good. And I think what we're learning is that at each of these interstices, in each of these breaks from one level of schooling to another, is tough. So the youngsters need a lot of support to get into first grade. They need a lot of support to get into high school. They need a lot of support to get into college successfully. It's each of those places where the children aren't backed up with a lot of books and being read to, and interest in the family around academic sort of things. You have to keep feeding them a little extra to get over the lip of the next level.
That is so true. And how about parent education? Did you work on that at all?
We didn't evaluate it, but it was a part of early care and education in North Carolina. That was, and it's the Ready Schools that were really working hard to get these early young learners up to speed, went out of their way to connect with parents and to encourage them. They need so much more. They need learning, perhaps, but they need encouragement that they're doing a good job almost more than anything else, and that their judgment about what the youngsters need is good, it's sound, and that they should trust themselves as parents.
Thank you so much, Lois. This has been so interesting and we've learned so much. Thank you for coming on. And thanks to all of you who have tuned in to this Sisters of the Holy Names Women on a Mission podcast. And until we meet again, may we all be women and men on mission. Thank you.
Thank you, Lois. Bye now, everyone.
Goodbye.
Bye.